In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour, it is Pentagon Solutions, where we look at the most difficult challenges the Pentagon is dealing with and talk to people both inside and outside the building about how to deal with those challenges and look for solutions to them. Today, I'm pleased to welcome in the studio two veterans of the E-Ring. Rudy De Leon is Senior Vice President of National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress and former Deputy Secretary of Defense and Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. And Dov Zakheim, former Undersecretary of Defense Comptroller from 2001 to 2004, a member of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan during its tenure, and author of the book A Vulcan's Tale, How the Bush Administration Mismanaged the Reconstruction of Afghanistan. Gentlemen, it is a pleasure to have you both in the studio today. I thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
I'm happy to do it. I'm going to start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room right off the top. We have managed to dodge sequestration, the January deadline, but we're now looking at a March deadline for sequestration. And the approach at the Pentagon each time is dramatically different. The administration said until the very last minute of the January deadline, this isn't going to happen. Congress will find a solution. We're not planning for this, and so on. This time around, it's dramatically different. Rudy, I'll start with you and your perception of the possible reasons behind the different approach this time around.
Well, I think, Francis and Dov, good to be on the program with you. I think part of the tension now is that for many years, there was a history of Congress finding solutions at the last minute. Now that can no longer be taken for granted. And so as a consequence, the Pentagon is now starting to plan for a sequestration. Some budget guidance in a preliminary form was issued. But that same agreement that avoided the fiscal cliff there on New Year's Eve also pushed the sequestration to February. And there's now a quirk. The appropriations was only for 6 months. So the appropriations for the Department of Defense expires at the end of March. If sequestration were to kick in at the end of February, there's really only 1 month's worth of appropriations on the table. So this makes a chaotic threat even more unpredictable.
Well, first of all, it's good to be with you, Rudy. I agree with Rudy. It's certainly unpredictable. At the end of the day, it's not the Pentagon that decides how to respond to sequestration. It's the White House. It's the Office of Management and Budget. And clearly the guidance out of the White House has changed. But it hasn't changed enough, I think, for the senior folks in the Pentagon to really make specific decisions. They've been given broad guidance, to my knowledge at least. Maybe Rudy has more insight into this, but to my knowledge, they have not been given specific guidance, which still makes it tough. And again, they've got a double-edged problem. On the one hand, you've got the sequestration issue that Rudy described accurately. But on the other hand, they have to worry about whether the continuing resolution will continue, as it were, throughout the year. The authorization has passed. The appropriations have not. The question then becomes, how does the appropriation committee, the two appropriations committee, how do they handle defense relative to everything else? And if there is a 12-month continuing resolution, what does that do to planning and to programming? So there are a number of really serious challenges facing the department that are, to a great extent, out of its control.
Rudy, the only guidance, concrete guidance that I'm aware of at this point is any changes that you make, anything that you do should be reversible if Congress comes up with a solution. That's the only thing I've heard so far.
Right, and I've seen some new guidance in terms of temporary hires, things like that. But, you know, in one sense, OMB certainly has a clear role to play here, but let's not leave out the Congress and particularly the House of Representatives. You know, we've danced around sequestration and government shutdowns before over the last several decades, but we're now in a mode where DOD is not separate, meaning that in the mid-90s, when there was a government shutdown about to occur, Congress actually got its act together and passed the Defense Appropriations Bill. Now we're in a mode where the best decisions Congress can make are 6 months at a time and across the board. So we're in a situation where not clear, been very difficult to try to put together a comprehensive budget agreement between the president and his representatives. And Jack Lew was part of the team that balanced the budget in the 1990s, so he certainly has considerable skill. So the challenge is, once again, how do we work together and find not the perfect path forward, but just simply a workable path forward?
The steps to try to find that path, Dove, as Rudy said, seem to lie somewhere in Congress. The administration has asked on any number of occasions for some kind of a solution to this. At what point do you think we see some kind of a break that allows that to happen?
Well, for a start, I think the fact that Mr. Boehner just today sent over to the Senate side a bill that avoids the debt ceiling crisis, at least for a few months. And Senator Reid has said he'll not only did he say he would get it passed, but he actually praised Mr. Boehner. Which is not something that commonly happens right now in Congress.
We don't see that often.
We don't see it that often, so we should cherish the moment, I suppose. But what it does show you is that the Republicans, I believe, at least the vast majority of them, have been quite serious all along about what it is they want and what it is they are prepared to negotiate. There is a very strong sense on the Republican side of the Hill that defense cuts should be minimized as much as possible for the simple reason that you already have a $487 billion cut. Now, whether they can succeed to that extent is, of course, questionable. They've got to work with the Senate. But clearly, if there is some movement on both sides of the Hill and on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue, I think you will see some kind of agreement, at least insofar as national security is concerned. Let's face it. We're still in Afghanistan. We've got our forces in lots of other places fighting Islamic extremists. We see a major crisis in Mali, and we're trying to support the French, who have the lead. But this world is not a quiet one. And clearly the president himself has said that he's not going to back down on what he considers to be the national security. So I still remain somewhat optimistic that a deal can be done, because at the end of the day, we're all Americans and we all care about our country.
So with all the balls in the air, is there a way to prioritize them, or is it necessary to try to manage them all simultaneously, Rudy?
Well, you always have to have multiple sets of challenges. But I think, Francis and Dove, the key issue is to come to an agreement on what the defense top line will be for the next 5 years through the administration. Back in the 90s, Secretary Cheney and then Secretary Aspin were able to work the defense budget issues that occurred after the Soviet Union ceased to be the significant power that it once was. They knew what the budget guidance was and were able to plan. And in that 90s, we started with a period of big deficits, and by 98, we had a balanced budget, and yet we still had a force that after the transition, after the 2000 election, was capable of deploying. Its readiness was high. So I think getting the top line set so that defense planners, as they look at the QDR and do the long-range future years defense budget, can actually have solid planning guidance. I think that's the number one challenge right now.
You agree with that, Dove?
Oh, I certainly do. I think there are clearly differences of perspective in terms of how you get to that top line. Democrats, many of them, will argue, look, in real terms, we're spending far more than we did 10 years ago, or even less than 10 years ago. Republicans will say, that may be true, but look how much more the personnel accounts are eating up. Look how much more individual units cost, so that, in effect, we are getting less for more money, and that is a big issue. And clearly, whoever is going to be running the Pentagon, and if Mr. Hagel gets confirmed, it'll be Mr. Senator Hagel, will have to look at how to make that place more efficient. I think there's consensus across the board that that has to be the case. We're, of course, also going to roll back the overseas contingency operations account, which this year is in the region of about $80 billion. Some of that's going to go into the baseline. So the question then becomes, how do you squeeze that into a baseline that already is pressured in part because the personnel accounts have been untouchable up to now, even, in fact, under the sequester? So those are some of the challenges that we face. But Rudy's absolutely right. Some sense of where we're headed at the top line is just so important to Pentagon planners.
All right. Then if we take for granted that at some point in the near future that top line is established, then the strategy that goes along with the top line is the next step. And, Rudy, you mentioned the drawdown in the 90s, and a number of people have cited that as, it's in some cases, a good model, in some cases, a bad model. So let's talk about, when we come back, a historic perspective on that, the things that we can learn and the things we want to make sure we don't do this time around. My guests in studio for Pentagon Solutions today, Rudy De Leon and Dov Zakheim, and we'll continue in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Please join Jim Fleisig on Tuesday, January 29th at 12 noon for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum, Cybersecurity, Defense and Homeland, Progress and Best Practices. The panel includes government leaders from the Department of Homeland Security, DISA, and the Department of Transportation. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum on Tuesday, January 29th at 12 noon, right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by Lockheed Martin, McAfee, and SourceFire.
Take your big ideas off the back burner. With HP Converged Infrastructure Solutions, you can spend most of your time and IT budget on your mission instead of IT operations. Servers, storage, networking, security, and management software work together to accelerate IT, greatly reduce application provisioning time, and get you ready for the cloud. Plan your strategy with HP Consulting for faster implementation and execution. The power of HP Converged Infrastructure is here. Learn more at hp.com/go/federal.
WTOP and the Washington Wizards are looking for the best junior broadcaster in D.C. Your child can join me, Dave Johnson, along with Glenn Consor as we call the Wizards-Houston Rockets game Saturday, February 23rd at Verizon Center. Plus, you'll get 4 tickets to the game and dinner in the press room. To enter, kids between the ages of 8 and 14 can submit an essay telling us why they should become our Wizards junior broadcaster. We're taking entries through January 18th. For all the rules, details, and to enter, visit WTOP.com, search Junior Broadcaster. Good luck.
Work in technology? The new career site PowerJobs.com is currently featuring senior-level technology positions from top companies like Accenture and Pioneering Evolution. Powered by Federal News Radio, Politico, and ABC7. PowerJobs.com is designed to connect Washington's top talent to top jobs in the region's influential industries. Visit PowerJobs.com today to start your job search. PowerJobs.com. Finally, a career site made for you.
So just how many ships can one ship be? Many, thanks to LPD Flight 2. Designed by the shipbuilders at Huntington Ingalls Industries, this next generation in the proven LPD class will provide America with a common hull ship for multiple missions. A ship that's built for flexibility, survivability, and affordability. Now that's innovation. Find out more at HuntingtonIngalls.com today. Huntington Ingalls Industries. Hard stuff. Done right.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON.
I'm Emily Kopp. On Thursday's Federal Drive, we'll meet the new cyber czar in the House of Representatives. Pennsylvania Congressman Pat Meehan tells us what he'd like the government to do differently on cybersecurity. And we'll look at the war room discussions behind a new strategy to clean up the Chesapeake Bay. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM today on Pentagon Solutions. Rudy DeLeon and Dov Zakheim talking about the challenges the Pentagon's dealing with, budget-wise, structurally, and so forth. The drawdown of the 90s is referred to constantly almost when it comes to the way that the Defense Department might deal with the budget over the next several years. Rudy, you brought it up first, so I'll start with you on this. What are some of the lessons that we learned during the 90s that worked on the defense rollback, and what are some of the things that we did that maybe we don't want to repeat this time around?
Well, so I think one of the big lessons learned was that in the drawdown, readiness accounts were protected very much. So O&M rates went up. Because the economy was so vigorous, some of the personnel accounts went up in terms of recruiting and retention bonuses, things like that. I think the area where we'd do a second look would be looking at modernization. And so the decision was made to go with the next generation systems, but we sort of ended up in a perpetual R&D cycle that in some respects continues to this day. So I think readiness was stressed. That was an issue both coming out of the Joint Chiefs but also out of Congress. So the readiness spending, O&M spending went up. Personnel accounts to recruit against the most vigorous American economy we've seen in terms of new jobs. But I think on the equipment side, really an R&D cycle, and so the next generation systems there was not a vigorous modernization effort in terms of procurement. There was vigorous R&D spending. So I think that's the one area to look at, that you've got to focus on readiness today, but recognizing that your equipment is readiness tomorrow.
Now, we have a different equipment situation now than we did then, because we were not coming off of two conflicts in the 90s with a need for a terrific amount of refreshment of that equipment.
Well, that's right. There's a lot of worn-out equipment, particularly land forces equipment, and so the challenge is, how do you modernize that? We have aging bomber force that just cannot go on forever. One, in theory, might slow it down somewhat, but one has to be very careful about how much that somewhat is. We have a naval force that may well be required in more places than it's been up to now. We have, for example, in the Eastern Mediterranean, the new gas finds pit the Cypriots of the north and the south and the Lebanese and the Greeks and the Turks and the Israelis and the Egyptians all confronting each other, with the U.S. Navy somehow in the middle of that. We already have Aegis ships deployed to reassure the Israelis and to sort of deal with the potential Iranian threat. And at the same time, the administration has talked about pivoting to Asia. And we can't walk away from the Indian Ocean region either, certainly not right now. So there's a demand on those forces. And so the acquisition problem, if anything, is more acute than it was in the 90s, and it was pretty serious then. On top of that, we have another challenge, which is, how do you manage acquisition? One thing that nobody seems to have been able to accomplish is, how do we reduce the time it takes to buy these weapons and keep these costs under control? This isn't a partisan issue. This is a bipartisan problem. And, in fact, this most recent effort to somehow deal with the problem was most unusual. We created a rapid acquisition system to get around our own system. Think about that.
The call that I've heard on several occasions, and Dov, you and I have talked about it off the radio about why it doesn't happen. But Rudy, the call that I hear is, we should just make the rapid acquisition system the normal acquisition system to be able to enable some of these things to happen. As I mentioned, there are reasons that that doesn't work, but right. The concept is certainly something that a lot of people are talking about, at least.
Well, you know, when we look at now R&D spending in the late 90s as well as the last decade, well, we see a lot of dollars in R&D, but we don't make the transition into production. One of the great strengths of the Reagan administration was that there was a host of programs that had been supervised by Dr. Perry, Bill Perry, when he was the head of Defense Research and Engineering in the Carter years. And you had Harold Brown, who was a Caltech, also an R&D man, And so from that R&D cycle, the M1 tank, the Bradley, the F-16, the F-15, the F-18, a whole host of the Aegis, the GPS, a whole host of technologies were ready for production. And then the Reagan budgets of the 1980s really put those things to market. So we were able to buy lots of equipment. So we had a clear R&D cycle and then clear procurements. I think now what we really do, and I think both Congress and the Obama White House looked and used that example of the Marine Corps helicopter that was to be the Marine One, the president's helicopter. Main mission of that helicopter is to get the president from the White House to wherever Air Force One is. But by the time all of the people that had a say-so on requirements got finished, it was no longer just simply a helicopter with good communications, which the prior helicopters had been. It had to have different survivability rates, to operate independently. A whole host of things, looking at them individually, made perfect sense, but it just broke the price. So that's one example where the requirements sort of got out of whack with what the system is. But I also think that in some of our next generation systems, we need to get them out there faster, which may mean they have subcomponents that come from the previous generation. So your advanced fighter, the F-35, may need to start out with the software from the F-16 so that you can get it deployed. The air wings can start operating with it, but we've got to figure out how to get the programs out there faster so that we can start modernizing and at the same time have upgrades to each generation of equipment, which we did routinely in the 80s and 90s.
Now, I've covered the F-35 program on a number of occasions on the show, and we have on the station. You mentioned some of the other programs that came out of the development cycle that you were talking about then, and maybe we can get some perspective on that, because the reputation of the F-35 program right now is not very high, and I wanted to see if we can get a sense of whether this is some kind of a new development that a program has these kinds of problems, or maybe we're looking at the good old days, maybe through rose-colored glasses. We'll do that when we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests today on Pentagon Solutions, Dove Zackheim and Rudy De Leon, and we'll continue in just a moment.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Listen to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM every Friday morning at 11 o'clock. Brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Fed Talk features live interviews with guests from the federal community sharing their insights on issues that affect you. Call in or email questions or comments to fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Fed Talk is sponsored by GEICO. This week on Fed Talk, host Jenny Mattingly will sit down with federal resume experts and hiring officials to discuss the latest trends in federal hiring.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
The next sequestration deadline is less than 2 months away, and that has put agencies in full-on preparation mode. The Office of Management and Budget and the Pentagon have both said unpaid furloughs for federal employees may be a necessity to deal with the potential budget cuts. Hiring freezes, early retirements, and cuts to travel and conference spending are also on the table. Agency leaders can get more information on furloughs through the Office of Personnel Management.
Does your spouse need additional or less expensive life insurance coverage? WEPA's Associate Member Program allows spouses of civilian federal employees to become associate members and apply for coverage up to $750,000. And the good news is that you, as the federal employee, are not required to purchase any insurance, and your spouse does not need to be a federal employee. To learn more, visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
September 3rd. I'm tired all the time. What's going on?
June 8th, I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
An ingredient for hangover helper. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss. With HHS HealthBeat, the only sure way to avoid a hangover is to not drink so much. But a study indicates it's possible to increase the chance of a hangover when drinking or to make one worse by smoking. Brown University researcher Damaris Rosenau found this when looking at 8 weeks of web survey data from 113 college students. Students recorded their smoking and drinking patterns and symptoms that would indicate a hangover. Their records indicated that smoking on the drinking day was worse than just drinking.
Those people who smoked more the previous day when they were drinking were more than twice as likely to report any hangover and report a more severe hangover when they did.
The report in the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on Pentagon Solutions today, Rudy De Leon and Dov Zakheim, both the veterans of the E-Ring, and talking about managing through the situation that the Pentagon finds itself in. And, gentlemen, first of all, I appreciate your candor on these issues because I know that the people who are making these decisions now are not only colleagues, but in some cases personal friends of yours. And so the sensibilities that are involved there, I understand those, and I'm grateful for your time and your information today. Dov, I want to start with you on this one because, as I mentioned before the break, we've covered the F-35 pretty extensively here, and the problems in the program are renowned. And to some degree, the same thing with the F-22. There have been some issues there as well. And my sense is that sometimes those of us that follow these issues dwell on the problems of the present and think about the good old days in a very nostalgic way. And Rudy mentioned a list of very high-tech, very high-profile programs over the last several years. Would we be unfair in saying that the problems that we see today are new and we've never seen them before?
Oh, no, they're certainly not new. I can think of, for example, Crusader, which Mr. Rumsfeld killed. I can think of the Aquila ARP remotely piloted vehicle that the Army developed in the late 70s that died a merciful death. On the other hand, I can think of the B-1, which ran into a lot of trouble and then was personally managed by Mr. Weinberger until it got out the door. One of the concerns that I've had for quite some time is that our system does not incentivize and reward particularly our civilians, to essentially continue their education. In other words, if you're a talented person, you have, say, earned an engineering degree at the age of 23 or 4 or 2, you stay in the department because they need you. Nobody wants to let you go off for a year or 2 years and study. But look at how technology changes. And so by the time this individual becomes a senior person, Moore's Law has kicked in several fold, and they're now dealing with technologies of which they really do not understand and are aware. What does that mean? It means we don't have an educated consumer, and that means we have to rely on contractors and consultants whose motives their hearts may be in the right place, but they come from a different place. And I think one of the big changes, I think Rudy would agree with me on this, is that over the years, our government expertise has significantly declined. And what that means is that managing complex programs, the F-35 or the F-22 or the littoral combat ship or God knows how many others, becomes harder and harder to do because we just don't have the expertise. And that's a problem, frankly, that the leadership of DOD at any time cannot solve by itself, because ultimately it's the Office of Personnel Management that has to pass these requirements.
Rudy, do you agree with that analysis? And if so, why do you think that this system has grown up this way? Dove is a certainly very wise person, but I'm sure not the only person to make that observation.
No, I think it's the nature of the technology has changed. I remember in Bosnia, we had an integrated operations center, but the integrated operations center was six people sitting in a room like this little studio, and we would talk across the table to each other to make sure that the land force was talking to the air force, that was talking to the logistics. Now you can do that all on a computer screen. And not only can you do it in an integrated operations center on the ground, you can do it in an aircraft or a helicopter or a ground vehicle. So we've moved away from the platform, the vehicle itself, the plane, the tank, the ship, being the critical component, to being the integration of all of these systems. And so this comes down to what are the really critical systems you have to have? What do you need to add with the first equipment being delivered versus what will you grow into the system as it advances? Because we want these systems to have a 20 and 35-year life out there. So some of it is the nature of the technology changing. The Google generation thinks differently than the aerospace generation. And so they're completely, you know, one wears white shirt and tie and the other wears fleeces. One will shave every day and the other will shave every other day. But they're both smart. They're both very capable. And so how to integrate sort of the Google world and the aerospace engineering world, I think, is one of our challenges. And it's as much a way that you think as a way that you actually manage.
And it's interesting to me how many of the challenges that the department deals with come back to those kinds of cultural and worldview issues, not ideological issues and not mechanical issues or management strategy type things, but really the same kinds of cultural issues that every other federal agency, probably every other organization in the business world is trying to deal with.
But I would say this, you're right. This is something that is a reflection of the transitional nature of our society. But the good corporations, the good businesses, are managing that. It is a management issue. And the question becomes, as Rudy says, how do you integrate these two very, very different approaches? But whether they're Google types or aerospace engineering types, they need to be educated. You cannot make a decision unless you have the knowledge. And in some respects, we still work with the 1883 Civil Service Act, and it needs to be updated. Because, again, if you look at person for person, man and woman in the Department of Defense, they are unbelievably dedicated. They're highly educated, at least coming in, no question about that. They work very hard. The hours at the department are quite remarkable. And so it's not the raw material that's the problem.
We are at the beginning stages of understanding the implications of the Google generation, I think. We're also at the beginning stages of implementation of a strategy and the decision-making process associated with a more formal strategy, and that's where we'll go next on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Dove Zackheim and Rudy DeLeon, my guests today on Pentagon Solutions, back in a moment.
Come back to Foggy Bottom for homecoming at the George Washington University on February 9th and 10th in 2013. Join GW Men's Basketball on Saturday, February 9th, when they take on the Butler Bulldogs and commemorate the 20th anniversary of their trip to the Sweet 16. The GW Women play Butler on Sunday and celebrate the 40th anniversary of Title IX. Visit gwsports.com/homecoming and get your homecoming tickets today.
Hey, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
On Sunday, January 27th, we will be live again at Union Market. Come on down and join us. We'll be talking to all the vendors there about doing your own Super Bowl party.
That's next Sunday, January 27th, live at Union Market, starting at 11, right here on 1500 AM.
Are you a federal employee or government contractor? FederalNewsRadio.com is the best source for news that helps you do your job better. Our news team brings you the latest on federal pay and benefits, technology, defense, retirement, acquisition, and the federal budget as it's happening. FederalNewsRadio.com gives a voice to the federal community. Read and hear interviews with federal leaders, members of Congress, and industry. Find it all at FederalNewsRadio.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our breaking news email alerts.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Rudy DeLeon and Dov Zakheim, my guests on Pentagon Solutions today. And we're starting to hear some buzz now, some talk around town about the beginnings of the process of planning the 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review. We did see from Secretary Panetta and General Dempsey in December, and then some follow-on guidance budget-wise in January. A strategy that is portrayed primarily as a pivot to Asia. There's also some information in there about a focus on the Middle East. And it's fair to assume, I think both of you would agree, that that will be the primary starting point, I suppose, mm-hmm. for the QDR process. But as we try to figure out all of the variables, we've talked about all the balls in the air that are being juggled at DOD right now, and I guess my question as an outsider is, where do you start to try to pull strands to tie together, given all the uncertainty, to even begin to shape a QDR if, as you said, Rudy, we're going on six-month planning cycles now? Mm-hmm. How are we going to think about something, that a product that comes out in 2014 and is supposed to guide us for the next 4 years?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What does that process look like in your view?
Well, the QDR is now mandated by Congress. So very shortly, the March-April time period, we'll be starting the work on the 2014 QDR. The people in the Pentagon will be. And so it takes the input on what is the budgetary resources available, although the QDR is to, by law, be requirement-driven. It'll look at what's the policy guidance. We're just coming out of two ground wars that lasted a decade each. So that has a O&M impact on the troops and their readiness, really the consumption of readiness when you put your ground troops on the table. But policy-wise, we know that the Middle East and the Pacific, Africa, as the hearing on the Hill this morning focused on. So the first big building block of the QDR will be the policy guidance. The second, we'll look at the integrity of the all-volunteer force. Ours is a nation that does not want to have a draft, so we've got to make the all-volunteer force work for the long term. We've really put it through a stress test. And so some of the issues, the medical costs in particular, need to have a full examination. O&M rates are higher than they've ever been. That because we want to have the troops be well-trained and ready, but I think that there may be at least information technology redundancy on the IT side. And then, as we've been discussing earlier, next generation equipment and making sure we've got the requirements right, because the technology is changing so fast. What's the best way to get the latest advance in technology? On IT, it may be off the shelf, but the platform would not be off the shelf. So how do we mold those two together? And then, knowing what the top line is going to be, what are the resources so that you can drive your priorities and focus accordingly. You know, we're coming off a period 2001 through 2013 where we've really not had a vigorous budget debate on resources. That follows a period of 1987 to 2001 where the Congress mandated in both the end of the Reagan administration, the first President Bush, and then the 8 years of the Clinton administration really had pay-as-you-go budgeting with very tight budget controls. So, you know, what's the right environment to meet the policy guidance, but then to drive the reforms that will allow us to continue with an all-volunteer force and get equipment into the field?
You know, Dove, Rudy mentioned that the process, the QDR process, is primarily requirements-driven. And I'm hearing, as I read and listen to folks talk about laying the groundwork for this process, kind of three schools of thought about it. One is we should be thinking about requirements first and then attach a dollar amount to each of those. The second school of thought is the opposite. The absolute first thing is we have to know the top line, and then we can put the pieces together kind of like a puzzle. And then the third is we have to try to marry those two processes together at the same time. Where do you fall on that spectrum, one of those three or maybe some other approach?
Well, the classic way it was done was to deal first with requirements, actually to deal first with our obligations around the world, with looking at allies to support and threats to confront. More recently, the case has been made that QDRs are indeed budget constrained, whether it is acknowledged or not. Clearly, when you have a whole lot more years to go to get to that $487 billion reduction, you know that there's going to be a constraint on budgets. The challenge is that however much the administration or any administration wants to focus on a particular area, things come up that drive you somewhere else. Years ago, I wrote an article called The Unforeseen Contingency. I challenge you to point out the last contingency, perhaps with the exception of Iraq, that was foreseen. We certainly didn't think we'd be fighting in Afghanistan, much less as long as we did. And frankly, we didn't foresee fighting in Iraq as long as we did. And nobody could have predicted several of the other places that we've been in. So you have the concern that on the one hand, there are some challenges that we pretty much understand we need to respond to. Iran is a good example of that. Challenges that we might have to respond to if things go sour in Asia. Challenges that we don't even know what they are at this point. In an environment where Congress has already mandated cuts and where the threat of a sequester or some other version of cuts hangs over the budget and the defense program as well. Then you have some other challenges that I think just have to be faced. One is you cannot be in more than one place at one time with one system. And that's a particular challenge for the Navy and the Air Force. The second is we have been saying for years that we need to work in a coalition format. We need to work more with our allies. And yet we have a technology transfer system that runs completely counter to that. We have, for example, a treaty, no less, with the British, who are among our closest allies, in terms of making it a lot easier for them to acquire our technologies. And you hear complaints out of London that it's not being implemented as quickly as they want it to. Well, where does that leave some of the others? And if we indeed want to work with other countries, we ought to be able to communicate with them. But if we can't communicate with them because we don't allow them to get our technologies, then where are we? Then we're by ourselves, in effect. And if we're by ourselves, the budgetary crunch makes it exceedingly difficult to buy the systems that we need to buy. So it's not a matter of, oh, requirements or, oh, budgets or, oh, some combination. It's looking at the totality of the challenge. And I think it's going to be very difficult to formulate a QDR that's implementable. There will be a QDR, but is it implementable? Is it the kind that allows us to pursue the priorities that we have as a nation? That's another matter.
I have a long list of topics that I would like to cover, and we have just a very few minutes left. So if you'll indulge me both in our next segment, we'll play a little word association game where I'll throw these topics out, and I'll give you each a sentence or two in response to try to cover a couple of these things quickly in the time that we have remaining. Rudy De Leon and Dov Zakheim, my guests today on Pentagon Solutions, on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll wrap up in a moment.
Military members receive 15% off select Sprint monthly services and for a limited time. Also receive a $50 service credit when they switch a line to Sprint. Visit a Sprint retail store in your area and mention the branch of the military for which you serve or visit Sprint.com/DOD. Retired military and veterans are eligible for Sprint's military discount and offers under the branch in which they served.
Coverage not available everywhere ends 4/10/13, subject to 2-year agreement, activation and early termination fees and other restrictions. Service credit will be credited within 3 invoices. Restrictions apply.
Join host Michael Keegan next week for the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance biomedical research? What's being done to ensure the soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risks, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Tune into the Business of Government magazine next week and find out. Hear from government executives next week on the Business of Government Hour.
This is an urgent message for all individuals with extremely large credit card debt. No matter how much you owe on your credit cards, the company that has settled more debt than anyone in the U.S. could settle your debt too. While you make one low monthly program payment, you have the opportunity to hear how low your monthly program payment could be for free. This free information is available now simply by calling Freedom Debt Relief at 1-800-700-6518. I repeat, if you have extremely large credit card debt, you now have the ability to reduce your total debt and get one simple low monthly program payment. This could allow you to resolve your debt faster than you ever thought possible. But you should act quickly. Call Freedom Debt Relief now to learn how much you could save. 1-800-700-6518. Again, this life-changing information is available for free. To find out how much you may be able to save, call today. 1-800-700-6518. That's 1-800-700-6518. 1-800-700-6518.
Work in government relations? The new career site PowerJobs.com is currently featuring powerful positions like Vice President of Government Affairs, Director of Legislative Affairs, and Deputy Political Director from top employers in Washington. Brought to you by Federal News Radio, Politico, and ABC 7. PowerJobs.com is designed specifically for you. Empowering today's top talent, PowerJobs.com.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
Job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview. Yeah. And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And as I warned before we went to the last break, I have a whole long list of topics here that I have wanted to cover today with Dov Zakheim and with Rudy De Leon, veterans of the Department of Defense. And we are about to run out of time, so I'm going to throw these out and we'll play a word association game with these gentlemen. We'll start with you on the first one, Rudy, Dov, because you mentioned it earlier in the program, and that's littoral combat ship. Just give me a sentence or two comment on that, please.
Grown much too much, costs more than people anticipated, and as a result, we don't have as many overseas buyers as we would have hoped.
Rudy, when you hear that term, what comes to your mind?
Just think, no matter how good the system, if the sticker price gets too high, it loses its importance.
We've touched on the emphasis on the shift that we've seen over the last several months and year. And one of the elements of that, Rudy, is air-sea battle. What is your thought on that?
Air-sea battle really was designed for the Asia-Pacific I think that we need to understand all of the dimensions before we jump into a different strategy and recognize that as much as Asia Pacific will be significant, so will the Middle East.
Duh.
On that one, I totally agree. I think air-sea battle may play an important role there as well. But as Rudy mentioned earlier, all of a sudden Africa is now front and center on a radar screen. How does that play into air-sea battle? Not at all clear. Europe hasn't disappeared, and certainly the Eastern Mediterranean, as I mentioned earlier, is important. We need to be sure that just as we have an air-sea battle strategy that's relevant to at least one part of the world, we need strategies that are relevant to all the parts of the world that are of concern.
Next term, and Dove, this one to you first, the People's Liberation Army and now their Navy as well.
Well, the Navy, of course, is the story. The People's Liberation Army originally was meant to deal with threats from the interior of the continent of Asia. China's outward looking. The real challenge is twofold. One, does this PLA Navy represent the kind of challenge that some people think it does to the United States Navy and to our role in the Pacific? And secondly, if we indeed depart from the Middle East, does the PLA Navy take our place?
Rudy, PLA and the Navy?
So looking at China and its rise reminds us that the most important thing the United States has to do is to get its budget act together, which includes not only paying the bills today and making sure that our armed forces are highly capable and effective, but making sure we've got the next generation of students that are going to be the engineers and the designers that are going to grow this global economy and be innovative, that we've got to look at China across the whole economic spectrum, and that I think getting our act together, as the Prime Minister of Australia told us, America is only one budget deal away from being the preeminent economic power. But remembering that the rise of China, that America's economic strength in the world is what makes our national security capabilities possible, and so getting our budget act together.
Rudy and Dove, it's been a terrific conversation this hour. Thank you both very much for your time. It is great to talk to both of you. Rudy De Leon, Senior Vice President of National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, and Dove Zakheim, author of the book A Vulcan's Tale, How the Bush Administration Mismanaged the Reconstruction of Afghanistan. This conversation archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And hour number two of In Depth with Francis Rose is next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.